ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
I thought it would be a really good idea after having next to no sleep for a few days that I'd have a can of Red Bull on the way down to hospital. So I get before this professor and the psychiatrist and I am off my head. It's like Pulp Fiction. I'm telling like five or six different stories of me and my life and what I think's happened, but it's all bunched around together. And I go, how the hell could they have interpreted any of that? And he had my personality and everything about me picked apart to a T within about 15 minutes. And I've gone, all right, respect.
I first heard Mark Thomas interviewed on the Police Veterans Victoria podcast called The Plodcast. What a great name for a podcast run by former police, which is available to anyone to listen to, by the way. Mark's interview really struck a chord with me. He was such a down-to-earth, honest and really unusually frank policeman that I found over working over a couple of decades. But he talked so openly about his battle with post-traumatic stress. But the difference with Mark is that he's still a serving current Victoria Police member. Mark was able to recover enough from his post-traumatic stress to be able to return to work, but much of that was because of the unwavering support of his supervisors. His immediate supervisor understood more than many about how to deal with a member trying to manage psychological injuries, and the difference that that has made to Mark's recovery is, to be honest, incredible. Mark loved policing. He loved helping people in their darkest, saddest hours, helping them when they believed or thought that there wasn't any help. He was the strong and steady head and hand that they needed, and he had it in bucket loads for the first 7 years of his career until the 8th of April 2003. Mark still doesn't know exactly what it was about this incident that affected him so badly. But affect him it did. It took 10 years for him to fall over or collapse psychologically. But there were little signs during those 10 years which Mark thought was just normal when being confronted with trauma in just about every shift of his policing career. He was becoming extremely mentally injured. Anyway, so thanks for your time today, Mark. Welcome to NFI on this first day of our daylight savings.
Morning, Narelle. How are you?
Very well. As I told you before, woke up and forgot to turn my clocks back, but everything's good now. And I believe you've had a bit of an issue this morning as well.
Yeah. Some clowns decided to clone my Facebook profile. So don't accept any friend requests from me out there.
As I said to you, they could do a lot worse.
No.
Anyway, so Mark, your first 7 years of policing, you said, was everything you expected. You just loved it. Yeah, there were sad times. There was traumatic stuff, stressful stuff. But to you, it was just such a good feeling to be able to help people, like you said. So tell us what it is that you loved about those first 7 years.
Well, it's that ability to put a smile on someone's face on their worst day. I reckon that's just an enormously powerful thing that we can do. And that, like, there's two instances. One, I went to a burg on Christmas morning where all the presents were gone, and it was, you know, like that, and they had small kids and, you know, just a horrible, horrible situation. So I grabbed one of the lads and I put him on my lap and sat him inside the police car and got him to let the sirens go. Some neighbours mightn't have been too happy, but bad luck. This was, you know, and then got him to switch the lights on and pretend that he was driving and things like that. And,
yeah,
for something so easy for us to do, it actually made a really bad situation just that little bit better. I mean, obviously, traumatic experience being burgled, but, you know, we were able to turn that around and, you know, they're the really cool sort of situations that you can do.
And what was the other one?
People, I've been asked a lot over the years, what's your the favourite shift you've ever done or the best experience? And, like, right up there is there was a youth portfolio member from Transit who bought a busload of Indigenous lads down. They were between 6 and 16 years old. And they were coming into Collingwood to go to the Collingwood Footy Club, and this is when I was working at Collingwood. And we got to spend the day with them, and it was just brilliant. Like, we took them to Victoria Park, and they had a kick around on the oval. Then we took them to the Fitzroy Gym, and Dean Rioli, who was then playing for Essendon Footy Club, he was there.
Oh, yeah.
And we managed to snag him, got him on the bus, and he had a chat to the boys. And then we went to the MCG that night, and these kids had never been to a city before. And I'm pretty sure it was Collingwood and Richmond playing. It's like 80,000 people there, and these kids were just like, it was quite frightening for them at one stage, but once they settled in, it was great. And that, like, they just had a ball. And this is the side of policing a lot of people don't see. And it was just a brilliant, brilliant day. And I think we're getting paid for this. This is pretty cool.
You know, that gives me goosebumps. I cannot imagine the thrill for you, let alone the kids, but for you to see those kids just so, you know, their eyes would be wide open, and to meet an Indigenous, just a magnificent Indigenous player. I hate to say it because he plays for Essendon and not Richmond, although we do have a Rioli in Richmond, or two now, but just the thrill of being able to, as you say, to see the thrill on those kids' faces, that's something they would never, ever forget.
Correct. And we were able to, yeah, we were able to do that. And again, you know, like, people, most people's communication with police is when they're being pulled over, or they've been, like, burgled, which I said earlier, or, you know, assaults and things like that. And they don't see or hear about the other side of it, and this side of it, and when I am asked that question, that is generally always the first thing that comes to my mind, because it was just such a special day.
And just not wanting to digress too much, but any time at the G with 80,000 people, no matter who is playing, it's a magnificent feeling, isn't it? So they're two of the moments that you just think are wonderful. And just going back to that, the burg that you told me about, or told us about, did you ever find those, I was going to say lowlifes, that's a terrible word, but did you ever find those people that did that burg on that house?
Unfortunately not.
Oh, okay.
And that was always, again, you'd understand this, one of the great things is processing people who do those burgs, just to give closure and comfort to the victims. But, yeah, unfortunately on that occasion it was a nil-none for us.
But you know, I think, again, like those Indigenous kids, those kids that were able to get in the police car and do that, that would be the best Christmas present ever.
Yeah, they enjoyed it. They let the sirens go a fair few times. Which is, there you go, boys, go your hardest.
You know, that's one of the things that I miss, and even us, like to put on the lights and sirens, or the blueies as we call them, oh boy, that gets the adrenaline pumping, doesn't it? It's a great feeling.
Yeah, massive adrenaline dumps.
Yeah, it is. So there's some of the great, thrilling things that you can do to help people. But then, as I said in my introduction, then came the 8th of April 2003. So could you tell us about that day in as much detail or little detail as you feel comfortable?
It was like, so I've been in the job 6.5 years or so. I graduated in October 96, and like every other copper, what we do, you see your fair share of trauma, and I was always okay with it because we had a job to do. Mm. Yeah, at the other end of that, you know, unfortunately, deceased person, to brother, a mother, a father, a sister, boyfriend, a girlfriend, etc. So we've got to do our job right. So their grieving period is as if we can help out in that period, obviously that's a good thing. But we rolled up outside. We got a call as a suicide. I won't go into detail, so I don't want to overtly trigger people. But we rolled up, and there's nothing different about it. But when I looked at the deceased, I looked at the deceased for all of 0.33 of a second, which Google tells me is the blink of an eye, and I looked straight away, and I physically felt it in my chest. It was something I'd never experienced before. I'd never reacted that way to a trauma scene or a deceased person before. Mm-hmm. So I just said to my officer, I'm out of here, which is, again, something I'd never done before. And I couldn't be in that room. If I was to describe in minute details, I can describe everything about the inside the unit and everything, what the deceased was wearing, what it looked like and things like that. It was like an image, a moment in time that was absolutely burnt into my memory. And like I've pulled apart that scene with Lummy, my Phil Lum, great mate, who I was working with that day, and we worked out that we were in the unit for probably anywhere between 6 to 8 seconds. Yet I can describe that scene probably better than I can describe my own house. Like it's just, which is, it's a fascinating thing that can all be burnt and imprinted into the mind. So I went outside. Whoever went in and discovered the deceased had evidently rang friends and family, so they started rolling up as well. So I elected to stay outside and give the death messages rather than go back inside and deal with the scene, which, yeah, I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of coppers over the years about this, and there's not too many who'd rather give death messages than deal with a crime scene. So, well, it actually wasn't a crime scene because it was a suicide, but deal with the scene. So I knew straight away something wasn't right within me. Like, as I said, I physically felt it in my chest. I didn't want to go back inside. I didn't. And then once the scene was clear, went back to the station, did the associated paperwork, and that was it, basically. And, you know, the first very major mistake I made along my journey, like I laugh, I have a little bit of a chuckle there. I obviously take this very, very seriously, but you know what? If I can't have fun with myself, you know.
Yeah.
Might as well. And that, because I didn't do anything about it. Like I knew something was wrong. The first phone call should have been to the police welfare unit. It was in existence then. But bearing in mind, this is 2003 and mental health education and was, you know, pretty much non-existent. And like, and I'm not just talking about Victoria Police, I'm talking about the community as an absolute whole, the world as a whole, really. And I was completely uneducated and naive to it.
I think we all are or were. I think it's only now that we're all starting to realise the damage that constant trauma can do to us. And it's not even about trauma. Like people, you know, get very stressed for a lot of different reasons. It's not just police, as you say, but we've got to get better, don't we? I think it's very slow.
Well, yeah, it's a generational change. Like you look back, and again, I want to specify, I'm not talking about just Victoria Police here. This is a community as a whole and the stigma surrounding mental health. You know, just think happy thoughts or just go have a few beers, that'll help, or get over it. The old, very, very harmful comments, that males would make, oh, you've just been a princess, you've been a little girl, that type of that type of behaviour and comments is just so incredibly detrimental to someone's mental health when they're already struggling. So, I'm not suggesting I copped any of that. I just didn't do anything about it. I didn't like the scene, move on.
But Mark, going back, you didn't do anything about it because you didn't think, like, because you, as you said, you were uneducated.
Yeah.
You didn't know that what to do, but you didn't know that there was anything wrong. You just felt that, I'm assuming you would think, who wouldn't be affected by what you were exposed to? And that's part of my job. I've just got to move on. Is that sort of how you felt?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And look, don't get me wrong, I don't lose any sleep over it now. I had that acceptance straight away. And when I say straight away, 10 years later when I was in hospital, which we'll obviously talk about later, but all right, it is what it is. I was uneducated. I didn't know. And it's even like people now, when they say stuff that's to me or they talk about it and, like, clearly they are uneducated. And I'll take that time to go, hey, look, just so you know, what you said then, that's actually quite stigmatising to someone with a mental injury or someone who lives with a mental health condition. So you probably need to rephrase that. And the vast majority of times they'll go, oh, geez, I didn't know that. Okay, yeah, good to know. So it's about that education. It's about getting people awareness. And I had none and, okay, so be it. I'll wear that.
Yeah, and can you tell us more about at the scene, as you said, point, what was it, 3/3 of a second
that you were? Yeah, blink of an eye.
Yeah, the blink of an eye. And you said you knew something wasn't right. You said in your stomach. Can you tell us more about that feeling?
Yeah, it's a very strange feeling, like the physical feeling I felt in my chest. I kind of say it was a whack, like a sharp whack of anxiety, because that's when I get really heightened anxiety, like a proper attack. I feel it in my chest, physically feel it. And I reckon it was that, and like I'm still amazed that, like, I literally, as quick as you can look one way and look away, that's how long I looked at the deceased for. Yeah, I can tell you he had a green T-shirt, grey cargo pants, no shoes, no socks, mousy brownie, short, curlyish hair, and I can talk about a whole lot more stuff, but I won't because it's pretty details.
Yeah,
but I can, and that's burnt into my memory, and I looked at it for 0.33 of a second, and it was a. Trying to put into words how it feels. It's like it's a shudder. It was like, say if you jumped into a pool that's 0 degrees or 1 degree, that initial shock that you get. Like it hit me. It was like an invisible wall come at me and just went whack. So
yeah. Isn't that amazing that for that small amount of time that you looked at the deceased, that your mind was able to take in all that detail. And I think you've told me before very briefly, you could also describe, let's say, the books on the bookshelf or the coffee cup in the unit. Like, it's just incredible what the mind can actually absorb in that small amount of time.
Yeah, correct. Everything about that flat, I can tell you where stuff was positioned, glasses, pots and pans, the colours. And as I was saying before, you know, we were in that flat for 6 to 8 seconds. And I took all of that in and, you know, it's basically imprinted into my brain.
Mark, can I ask you, that is, from my point of view, that's a little bit unusual and I think the listeners might feel the same. Why were you in there for that amount of time and you got out? Because normally you would have a bit of a look around, you'd, oh, God, what's happened here? I just think that's a little bit unusual to be in and out so quickly. Was there a reason? Did you just need to get out? You thought you were going to be sick or?
Yeah, we went in. It was a one-bedroom flat and we had a fair idea what had gone on. So we walked in, peeled around to the right, just a quick glance, looking around, and I looked around a wall and the deceased was there and then I'm out. I just said, I'm out. It was just everything just happened so quickly because we had an idea that this had just happened and we might be able to save this person.
Okay, yeah.
So it was very but also the door was open about an inch. So we're also mindful that, you know, are we walking into something here? Are we walking into an ambush or something? So to scan around the flat, look everywhere, blah, 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 bang, there's a deceased, I'm out. And it was an instant decision. It wasn't like, oh, geez, I don't know whether I can be in here or not. It was just, nah, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah.
So.
And really, in a one-bedroom flat, and I get, please, you know, it's not a criticism at all. It's just fascinating. But I'm thinking now, the one-bedroom flat, you've seen what you've seen. Really, what is the point of being there?
Yeah.
You know, just get out and just let the other expert. Yeah. I get it.
And that, that absolutely agree with what you just said. But like that was. That wasn't on my mind to let other people take care of it. It was just, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah. Mm. You said that you went back to the station and did the paperwork, et cetera. How were you for the rest of the shift and, I don't know, say that night? Like, did you experience some reactions that you weren't expecting or?
I can't remember totally what the rest of the day was like. A couple of things. So me and Lummy, for whatever reason, not every time we'd work together, but the majority of times we'd get an overdose or a fatal or something. Like, it was just one of those things. But mind you, this is Collingwood in the early 2000s, which was one of the heroin hubs of the whole metro area. So it was pretty, there's lots of carnage. So every time that had happened, we'd go down the pub, have a just a debrief, just have a couple of rums each, and as we do, and yeah, you know, certainly not get on and give it a massive nudge, just to chill out, and that was the normal thing. I remember we did that, and I don't remember the rest sort of the day before or after. I obviously remember the middle, but my wife, since. Years later after I was out of hospital and stuff, she's going, you were different that day when you got home. There was something about it that you were different. And I don't remember what I was like, but certainly I was, there was something which it was sticking out where Karen picked it up.
Isn't that, I was going to say strange, I don't know if that's the right word, but obviously in those previous 6.5 years, you had been to a lot of other traumas, a lot of other concerning incidents. So it's not like this was the first time you'd ever been confronted with something like that. It's really, just how the mind works. It's incredible.
Fascinating. Mm. I hadn't been to that type of suicide before. So I think there's something about that my brain just wasn't built to be able to cope with or... like there's arguments that, you know, was that the the final drop of the bucket, my bucket overflowed, which I don't think it was, because, you know, I went to a fatal not long after that, and I can't remember much about it. Like, I went through my day book just to see what I went to after it, just to try and work out in my own mind basically what we're saying. It's like, what is it about this? And this fatal, I didn't even remember this fatal. But then I go going through my notes, I had pages and pages of notes. I'm going, yeah, that's right, that's right. Oh, yeah, I remember that now. But it doesn't bring up any emotions in me. It doesn't do anything. It was just another job that I went to, albeit, you know, a tragic one. But it was, you know, like it didn't register.
Yeah, no, I get that. Gee, I get that.
So yes, so fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so what and when was the first sign that maybe you hadn't managed the incident as well as you thought you had?
A few months later, when I got my first detective position at the old TRS, and when I landed there and when I got my Yellow Freddy, you'll know what the power is when you get your first Yellow Freddy.
Yeah, we'd better explain just a couple of things there first. The Yellow Freddy and the TRS.
So the Yellow Freddy is in uniform. Your badge, your police ID is blue, light blue. When you become a detective, it turns to yellow, and the police ID is called a Freddy, so the Yellow Freddy.
Yeah.
So that's the aim. And the old TRS was the Tactical Response Squad, which is not tactical in the sense that guns and, you know, things like that. It's responding to kidnappings, blackmails, extortions, product contaminations, that kind of one of the crime squads.
Yeah.
So when I got there, like, my aim was to always become a detective. But when I got there, I thought, good, I don't have to deal with trauma anymore. It wasn't the Yellow Freddy that I was most pleased about. It was that I didn't have to go to traumatic incidents anymore. And at the time, it means nothing. With a fair bit of knowledge and treatment and a lot more healthier brain, that's a huge red flag.
Absolutely it is, yeah. Huge.
So and then whenever probably, you know, this goes on an upward scale. That's not scaling upwards. My use of the little language isn't real good. It gets worse and worse each year, but whenever I'd hear about a trauma incident, my body would heat up a little bit, and I now know that's my anxiety rising. And I was just avoiding certain TV shows, movies, things like that. Whenever a certain event was going to happen on movies, I'd turn away from it. Again, meant nothing then. Now means, yeah, huge red flags going left, right, and centre.
So when you were getting hot, like you felt uneasy, let's say, and you couldn't look at these scenes or whatever, did you tell anyone? And if not, why not?
I didn't tell anyone because I just had no idea. It's quite, and again, this is the fascinating aspect of it all to me now when I look back at it. Like, I certainly wasn't ever the world's best copper, but I certainly wasn't the world's worst. And one thing, when doing drug warrants, you know, like, I'd always be very good at finding the drugs, thinking outside the box, so to speak, where's a good hiding spot? And I found some ripping hiding spots, and I could do that. And,
yeah,
you know, I was always very a people watcher, and I want to know why things work, and the next thing. Yet I've got these major events happening inside me and I had no idea. And that's like, I was never running away from it. I was never aware that, oh, you know what, I'm mentally injured here, but I can't, I feel weak. I never had any of that. Like, and I never have, but I just didn't know. How I didn't pick up on the signs is absolutely beyond me.
And, you know, that's funny you say that, because when I do my talks, I put up a slide of the signs that I ignored or I just didn't understand. And I say every
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Time. Now, when I put up this slide, you're going to think, how could you possibly ignore that or not know that there was something wrong? But like you just said then, you don't know, so how can you talk to anybody about it? You don't understand it. And that is why we need to educate people, which is exactly what we're doing now, but why we need to educate people about mental injuries and mental health, because then people might understand earlier and not be in the position I am and that you've gone through yourself. So many. That's what we need to do. We need to talk about it.
Spot on. Spot on.
Yeah, I know. So by 2013, you were a shell of the person that you were, let's say, prior to 2003.
Yeah, that was the culmination,
what happened?
Really. So basically that incident I attended in 2003 had just started chipping away at my resilience. And by the time 2013 came along, I just didn't have any resilience left. I went to Nepal, which was a bucket list item to do the Annapurna Circuit in September 2012. And I got basically about halfway through the trip, or actually not even that, probably 4 or 5 days into it, you know, like, I'm sitting in my room, nestled in the Himalayas, this, you know, awesome river raging, just unbelievably brilliant scene, but I'm in my room crying and I had no idea why. You know, like, looking back on that now, because depression was just strong within me. And like, I had my first, about a week later, I had my first real proper anxiety attack, and I thought I was going to die about 4,000 metres in the Himalayas, and very scary.
Can you tell us about that panic attack?
Yeah, like it was – it'd been building for a few days. And, because I didn't know what was going on, I didn't sort of put a whole lot of thought into it. But I remember we got to a place called Yak Kaka, and I was sitting outside. It's about 4,000 metres. And I was cold, so I put the jacket on, and I just felt something is definitely not right within me. And that was one of the first times I've sort of sat in it, to use that terminology. And then I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go up, I'm going to lie down on bed, and I'm going to have a big sleep, and I'll wake up tomorrow and it'll be right. You know, standard male attitude, it'll be right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I remember lying down on the bed and looking out the window, and there's some stars out by this time. So, yeah, pretty good sight. And then my body started heating up and heating up, and I started like to the point where I'm sweating. I'm like, what's going on here? And then the brain sort of starts going in the washing machine mode, where all the thoughts are bouncing around. Started to shake a bit, and then, felt a little bit physically sick, as if to vomit, but not huge, but just the body was hot by now. And, I was shaking, and then I started to get quite emotional, and the bloke I was rooming with, he woke up because he's already sleeping, and he goes, whoa, what's going on here? He went and got the Trek leader, who come in, and by that time I'm, in complete meltdown mode.
Gee.
And again, not making light of it, that's just the terminology I use for me. The Trek leader had some good skills. He just put his hand on my shoulder nice and gently, and he just told me to breathe, 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 breathe. So I started to sort of slow my breathing down a bit, and got me down to a point, and he said, do you want to turn around? I said, yeah, I'm going home. So I turned around the next day, and he cut one of the porters loose with me, and we walked back to, 100 Ks in 2 days to get to a bus, to get back into Kathmandu, to get back to Australia. But what the best part of that, the best part, I say that in inverted commas, I developed the morning I turned around, about 15 minutes into it, and I'd already been walking for a week and a half, all of a sudden I developed this massive blister underneath my right foot. And it was painful, physically painful, but I loved it because it was taken away from all the mental pain that I was in. So then I tell myself on the way back, I'm booking to see a psych as soon as I get home because clearly something's not right here. And then, of course, I get home. I'll do that tomorrow. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow came to the 6th of February 2013. So, again, 5 months later, I still haven't booked in to see a psych. And the crime department and Intel Covert Support, I was in Intel, had a dual training day for health and wellbeing. Ah, cool. I'll go for a look. And Joe was up there, one of our lead psychs, champion bloke. And he had a slide up on the screen that had all these boxes that related to PTSD, depression, anxiety, and suicide. And I distinctly remember him. This is one of the flashbacks I've got. I can still see him stand there going, don't worry if you tick a box or two. Generally, everyone does.
What about every box?
And I'm sitting there and I go, I'm ticking every box.
I knew you'd say that. Yeah.
And I'm like, it's good that I can laugh about it now, and I love how laughed then.
I can too.
Can picture it. And I developed this feeling in my chest. It was that same feeling, and it's like the devil's butterflies. That's about the only way I can sort of describe it, which, again, is that anxiety coming up, and I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. And that's – I realised – I'm in a world of trouble here. So once his lecture was over, I went outside and I finally called welfare and booked in to see a psych, which was for the following Monday, but I'd never get there at 3 o'clock. I had this thought that, you know what, beauty, I've booked in, I'll go there, I'll have a session, I'll be right. I reckon I've had 250 psych sessions since, and I've still got a lifetime of treatment ahead of me sort of thing. So, not treatment, maintenance now more than anything. But so I thought, all right, that's done. Then I went home Wednesday night and I just felt worse. It was like I was on a slippery slide and nothing was stopping me. I'm gonna crash. And again, that's looking back. So I got home Thursday night, Friday. And well, as at work, I was fine because I had something to do when I was – No one picked it up. Karen, my wife, did say, you need to go see someone about your sleeping habits. They're deplorable. And I said, well, I'm a shift worker. That's what happens. So, yes, that's the white flag goes up each and every time. Well, if you had to listen to me, yes, true. I was wrong. You're right. So then I woke up this Saturday morning with a raging toothache, which is exactly what I needed. So, and that is sarcasm. So I
gathered that. Thank you.
So I booked in to see an emergency dentist, and sure enough, root canal treatment, which was brilliant. And then woke up in the Sunday morning, and I was working the cricket that day, voluntary duties. And like, I love cricket. I've played it all my life. It's my favourite sport, and I hated it. Absolutely hated. Just didn't want to be there. And when I caught myself thinking, I don't want to be here. Now, I might, when I'm sitting at the cricket, and I'm sitting on the ground, like getting paid to watch cricket, how good is this? But I was trying to determine, I don't want to be here. Do I don't want to be here at the cricket, or I don't want to be here on this earth? And I couldn't make that distinction. I didn't know. So I was just so, and this is not quite the worst I've got, but the game finished and beauty, I want to go home. And I got home, I think it's about 11:40, 11:45. Just, you know, did a couple of things for 10 minutes and I went to bed, and within 2 minutes of going to bed, I had what my first treater, first psych in hospital called a catastrophic loss of self, which sounds rather large. So basically,
it is.
Yeah. I've had it. So I know what it is. So what that looks like is, I don't like the terminology mental breakdown. I don't like it. I don't like the, it's icky to me. But that's what people sort of understand. And it was a case of, I had no resilience. I had no self-worth. I had nothing. You know, I was living and breathing. I was surviving. So that was, but for some reason, my normal human brain shut down and my policing brain kicked in, which was very handy. So I grabbed my phone and gave it to Karen and said, ring welfare. I can't remember exactly what I said, but, you know, I wasn't in good shape. So I'd had a huge anxiety attack. I was very wet and sweaty, wet as in, you know, sweaty, pretty emotional. So, yeah, it wasn't hard to work out that I wasn't in a particularly good spot at this moment in time. And then Karen rang welfare, and very shortly after that, the on-call psych rang. And she said, what are we going to do with you? And she said that in a good way, kind of, you know, like, what's your thoughts? And I remember saying, well, if I'm me and I'm working and I come here and I speak to me, I'm saying you're going to hospital. Because I wasn't in any danger, I don't think. I can't be 100% sure. I'm pretty sure, though, that suicide was never an option. Actually, I've contradicted myself. Suicide was never an option because I lost my mum when I was 8. So I know what it's like to grow up without a parent. So I'm not going to let my kids grow up without their dad through my own hand. Like, mum was taken with from cancer. So that's, you know, so many people are in that same situation as me. So I'm not going to let that happen. So I need to go to hospital because I don't overly feel safe. It's a little bit murky in that area. So I had a night in Footscray emergency, which was probably an experience unto itself if I actually had any proper thought processes going on. And then a night in Footscray short stay unit. And I was... And again, trying to put words around these things is really hard to describe what it's like. Just not capable of thinking much. Just a shell. It's hard exceedingly difficult to describe. And it's when you speak to people that understand, that have been through the same thing, it's just this little sort of nod at each other. Yeah, know what you're talking about. And then I went down to the Geelong Clinic for a week and a half, so nearly a couple of weeks in hospital all up. So when I arrived down at Geelong, I had a meeting with a professor and a psychiatrist. And at this stage, like, I didn't dislike and nothing against this, you know, the psych community. It's just I'd never really dealt with them. Like, oh, yeah, whatever. But this professor, and like, I thought it would be a really good idea after having next to no sleep for a few days that I'd have a can of Red Bull on the way down to hospital.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Sorry, so, excuse me. That just came out.
Yeah. So I get before this professor and the psychiatrist and I am off my head, like talking. I'm telling a part of this story, a part of that one. It's like Pulp Fiction. I'm telling like five or six different stories of me and my life and what I think's happened, but it's all bunched around together. And then I stopped and I look back and I go, how the hell could they have interpreted any of that? And he had my personality and everything about me picked apart to a T within about 15 minutes. And I've gone, all right, respect. Diagnosed PTSD, depression, anxiety, at that stage was like, huh, that makes a bit of sense. Because my policing brain was still sort of going quite strong. And I thought, now things are starting to add up. And then I went to a room, shared with another bloke. He was coming off meds, so he was having a bad time of it. So I went to another room, which was a single room, single bed. And one of the first things I noticed when I walked in is a suicide-proof room, whereas the other one wasn't. And I thought, that's interesting. So I walked into the shower, bathroom area, pushed down on a handrail, and the handrail just collapses, so there's no hanging points. I thought, okay, that's interesting. And then of a morning, I was only allowed to go out if I was supervised. And then so we'd go for a morning walk, supervised. And then on the little tick sheet, I had a little bit of a sneaky look at it, and they had me the criteria of high risk of self-harm suicide. So that was confronting to see that. And again, when I'm talking about my normal human brain would have gone, whatever. But my policing brain was like, okay, shit's getting pretty real here. Okay, all right. So now I'm trying to plan what my life looks like. But then I'd think for a couple of minutes and I'd be exhausted. Like it was just all the gas had been taken out of me. And then we'll have a couple of sessions with the psych every day. And at one stage, it was pretty early on actually, she said, geez, you're weird. And I thought, that's exactly what I want to hear when I'm locked up in a psych unit. And she goes, no. What I mean is that people who sit in that seat there hardly talk. I cannot get you to shut up. And I'm still looking at her going, and she goes, and that is a really good thing. Ah.
Oh, good.
Oh, okay, so it's good to talk. Because I did work out pretty early that the more I talk about it, the better I feel.
Yeah.
And look, to be honest, in those stages, in those early days, if you could feel 1% better or 0.5% better, it was a big relief because it was it's just a bad – it's the Badlands. It's a bad, bad place to live. So that all got through about another week or so, and then I kind of say this half jokingly when I'm presenting about it, and I sort of say for those of you that haven't been locked up in a psychiatric facility, and it hardly ever gets a laugh because people are still a bit
really.
This is it's a little bit confronting, but I don't see it as confronting because I've lived it and I've spoken about it 1,000 times.
Yeah,
But it was really good because I had people come in and just little lessons every day. So there's, you know, on diet, they'd get a dietitian come in and then an exercise physiologist maybe. They'd come in and talk about the power of exercise. And this lady came in one day and spoke about mindfulness. And I'd never heard of the word. I thought, oh, that sounds pretty cool. All right, yeah, I'll give that a go. And then it was the Friday night of the first week I was in there and I was lying in bed. Like, I didn't want to speak to anyone else other than the psychs and the nurses. I wasn't there to make friends, basically. And I just, like, I had to sleep with the night light on and I had to sleep with the door open and, like, there's all this different stuff going on which is just so foreign to me. And I started feeling worse and I didn't think I was capable of feeling worse, but I could feel myself slipping downwards, further down the rabbit hole. So I thought, ha, mindfulness, I'm going to give that a go. And she said, have a shower, either just pure cold shower or have a hot shower, not so it scalds you. Have the water on the back of your neck and just concentrate on the water and it'll help ground you. All right, I'm going to give that a go. Now, being a huge, huge sook for cold water, that was never an option. So I'm going to go the hot water. But psych clinics don't have hot water because then people can self-harm. So it's lukewarm at best. So my first attempt at mindfulness was a flaming failure. And then I just found, like, I sunk down and I was just sitting down. I had my knees against my chest and that was me bottoming out. Like I wasn't crying. I was, you know, too, you know, you can use the word sad, but sad's not the, it doesn't represent where I was. Like it was a place where I had the most unbelievably powerful realization. Ah, this is why people suicide. Because it's just not sustainable to continually live with this feeling. And this feeling of utter despair, it's just black. It's the most horrible, horrible feeling. And, like, part of me knew that I was really early in my treatment. I wasn't medicated, but there's always medication. I've got a great family. I've got great friends. I've got a supportive workplace. You know, I've got all these positives around me that I know will help get me back. But sitting there going, for people who don't have support, there's only one way out because you can't live. You can't live with that amount of mental pain. You just couldn't do it. So it took me, and I was telling myself, get up, call a nurse, get up, call a nurse. It took me 10 minutes to actually get up, dry, get dressed, hop back into bed, press the nurse's button. Like 10 minutes. Like it's amazing, amazingly bad because it's just had such an unbelievably strong power over me. So then the nurse walked in. She said she had this little grin on her face. You don't look too good, which was like.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, no. Nah,
I actually feel like shit.
But, like, we'd already had a fair bit of, you know, black humour. She knew about that kind of stuff. So, which was, you know, I'd much rather that than her coming going, oh, sweetie, you don't look too good. You know, are you okay? Nah. So, she said, can I give you a Valium? She goes, I know you're not medicated and you don't want to be medicated just yet. And I said, yeah. And look, to be truthful, she could have said, so what I basically said to the professor in my first meeting, he said, let's talk medication. And I said, well, let's not. He kind of looked at me. And I said, look, I'm not against it, but I want to see how far I can take it first before I need medication. And I'm medicated now and I'll be probably medicated for the rest of my life and that's fine. But I just wanted to see how far I could take it. And truth be known, when that nurse came in the Friday night, she could have said, I'm going to give you a magic pill, take it all away. I wouldn't have cared what it was. Just give me it.
Yeah.
I could not live with that pain. So So she gave me a Valium, and I remember I was sitting back watching Austin Powers Gold Member on the TV, and the Valium was just brilliant. It just she said, look, it's a muscle relaxant. It'll help you relax. And I felt it. I felt felt like I was resting into a cloud. And that's I've got to be very, very careful with how I use Valium. Like, I haven't had one for months and months and months, and I've got them everywhere, stashed everywhere, at work, in the car, at home. But they're just a safety blanket because they are obviously powerfully addictive. So you've got to be very, very careful with the usage of them. So, and that it basically put me to sleep, and I woke up the next day and I wasn't in that mental pain anymore. I was still feeling completely and utterly shit ass, but I didn't have that real excruciating pain, and I haven't been there since, back to those levels, which is obviously a good thing. And that's why I feel incredible empathy for the people who do take their lives, because I know, I don't know what they're going through, but I've got a fair idea what their brains were doing to them.
You said that there's just one thing there that I there's a number of things I'd like to ask you about. But first of all, I just think it's interesting that it wasn't only your mind that was shutting down when you talked about the toothache and, let's say, the blister when you were in Nepal coming back. So your body is also shutting down, isn't it? All these major things are happening because, it's just shutting down. And the only other thing, half sort of amusing, but I thought it was interesting that you just said then when you didn't want the cold shower, you said, I'm a bit of a sook for cold water, but yet you'll go to the Himalayas and freeze your bits off.
Yeah.
Like, really?
But you can warm up. I love winter. Winter's great because you can warm up. But sitting in cold water. But that's like, I've tried to have cold water showers because they're really good for you, and I struggle with it. I struggle.
I just saw the amusing side. Hey, so can you tell us when you were in hospital, you started to think about how you could help other people in this position, that you didn't want anyone to go through this? Tell us what happened. Isn't Mark just amazing to listen to? Next week, Mark takes us through the difference between a companion dog and an assistance dog, and the amazing story about Jimmy, the assistance dog, who Mark has watched in action, and the deep understanding that Jimmy has with his companion, who is a very troubled policeman who's learning to go out in public again, and thanks to Jimmy. Mark also talks about the power of having a supervisor who understands mental illness and the difference that he made to Mark's working life. Mark's been able to return to full-time work because, and only because, of his supervisor's knowledge and understanding of, let's say, PTSI in particular, but mental illness. Also, Mark talks about some recruits that have started seeing a psych and forming a relationship, being proactive before they actually get out onto the street. And I just think what a fantastic message something is getting through out at the academy to the recruits. I just think what a great idea that is. And just lastly, which I think this is more important to me, not that the other stuff isn't, but Mark shares with us the changes which have slowly been introduced into Victoria Police members who are required to view child abuse material, as I was, and which I have no doubt was my undoing. He tells us about the graduated approach that VicPol are taking in exposing members to child abuse material rather than almost like dumping them into this horrific world which many of us couldn't deal with. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this week, but trust me, next week is just as amazing. Have a great week. Bye. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.